Hubbardbroadcasting.com. This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Interfacing complete. Please stand by. Now downloading Tech Talk Radio with Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ. Tech Talk Radio, it's technology you can understand. And now here are Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ.
Welcome to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. I'm Dr. Richard Schertz.
And I'm Jim Russ.
And another great, exciting week in technology. Google was down for 2 minutes.
2 minutes?
Every Google service was down for 2 minutes last Friday.
No kidding.
Yeah, we'll talk about that briefly later in the show. And of course, NSA continues to be in the news.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll have to go through to talk about exactly what NSA is doing. Actually, what they claimed they were doing, and then what the Washington Post said they were doing in an expose based on Snowden's papers that were, you know, released without authorization. And they're even changing how they are routing data in Germany and Europe, because they don't want it routed through U.S. servers now. So this is actually going to have a serious impact on cloud computing in the U.S. because now nobody's quite certain what's going to happen.
Hmm.
And the feds are beginning to take a look at Bitcoin. Of course, that's
we've talked about these guys.
Yeah, Bitcoin. I'm going to go in and talk more about Bitcoin. And now they're beginning to look at how they should regulate it, because they realized we've got a currency that's not tied to any country, and they're just a bit worried about it. This week we're going to feature the godmother of Unix administrators, Evie Meenith, she was the godmother of Unix administrators. She's got quite an interesting story, and we'll feature her this week. And, of course, it was a huge mailbag.
Amazingly big.
There's a letter in your mailbox.
Oh, yeah. Here we go.
Boom. So that was kind of
wimpy.
Half-hearted.
Yeah, I know.
I wasn't going to say wimpy.
Okay. Let's get this thing up here.
Right.
Okay, here we go.
Oh, that's much better.
Okay. Tell you, this is a heavy, heavy mailbag. We got an email from Alice in Wonderland. Okay.
Alice.
I had no idea that Tech Talk was playing down in Alice in Wonderland.
Well, you know, we're in a lot of places. Technology being as it is.
It's got to be by podcast of the internet, because that's underground and the airwaves aren't probably going to make it down there.
No, probably not.
Okay.
Well, AM signals travel through the ground, so it's possible.
Oh, really?
Yes.
How far down do they?
I don't know, but that's part of the way that AM radio is propagated. If you go to an AM radio tower, mm-hmm, and you were to dig up the ground, you would see copper strips emanating from the tower itself, and that's called the ground plane.
Okay.
And that's the very little technology that I have to add this morning.
Yeah, I'm very familiar with the ground plane, yes. So we have an email from Alice in Wonderland. Dear Doc Schertz, your Saturday reply was most helpful. She was the one, if you remember last week, Alice in Wonderland wanted to connect the internet to her TV.
Yes.
Then she wanted to see what kind of programming you should get. But now I need a bit more clarity.
Clarity, please.
On how I actually get into this kind of content. I used to live in Seattle. There's a great radio show there where they covered all kinds of innovation, medical, biotech, banking, bicycles, whatever anybody could think of.
Mm-hmm.
And they told a very riveting story. And I lived on the left coast for a decade, and I did enjoy those kind of stories, but things are different there. Well, we know that.
Yes, because
there's hardly a word about Congress and how they should live. Anyway, it is my suspicion that with the vast amount of stuff on the internet, if I buy something like Roku or Google TV, I'll find a whole universe of knowledge that I can locate. But I'm not really into movies. I want to learn stuff. So how am I going to get this content on my TV? I don't really quite understand the whole connection. Thanks, Alice in Wonderland. Okay, Alice. Actually, attaching your TV to the internet's not really that magical. You're just using your computer, your TV, as the computer that accesses the internet. And you can stream live video to it, like using Google TV, Apple TV, or Netflix. But then if you want to just surf the web, it just has a browser built in.
Mm-hmm.
So you'll have a browser either. I mean, if you're using your DVD player, that'll have a browser built into the DVD player. Or you could have, if you're using Google TV, you'll have a browser built into the Google TV box. So there's a browser built in there. And so your internet access is using the browser interface, just like with a regular computer. So there's really no difference between what you see on the TV, what you see on the computer. Just the display is different. Now, the only problem is that you may want to, if you're going to really use the browser on the TV and sit back and just, you know, surf the web, you're probably going to want a keyboard and a mouse. It's just a lot, instead of trying to use the remote control.
Sure.
And moving the little arrow around. And if you don't have a keyboard, then there'll be a keyboard that shows up on the screen, and typing with the screen keyboard
would take forever, right?
It would take forever. So, so what I would recommend, like if you end up getting Google TV, Logitech has a keyboard controller for Logitech Review and TV, and it's about $60. And it would be, you know, probably a Wi-Fi connection to the Google TV, and then you've got your keyboard there to operate your browser. So there's really nothing magic here, you know. And so the key is to which kind of streaming media you used. You're going to want to look at the content that they have. So you're going to want to look at, if they've got Google TV, you want to look at what kind of free stream, because I gather you want only free stuff.
Right.
What kind of free stuff Google TV is going to have streaming for you. Apple TV has other kind of free stuff that you can stream. Netflix, of course, it's all movies. And there's a lot of broadcast channels that stream either with Google TV or Apple TV, so you can see which channels are there. So I think you need to do some specific research to see what content you want in terms of the streaming media. And as for all the other stuff on the internet, it's just a browser, and you're just surfing the web as you would with your computer. But great question, and I hope, Alice, that you can solve this dilemma and get attached to the internet.
Yes.
And watch whatever you want.
Mm-hmm.
We got an email from Hawk in Bowie. Dear Doc and Jim, I live in Bowie, Maryland. When I go to a website, the content will often say things like, find sexy singles in Bowie.
What?
Now, I use spyware software religiously, so I don't know how they can find where I live. What? How do they know that I live in Bowie? You know, these aren't local websites that I'm visiting.
Because they listen to Tech Talk.
Yeah, I love the show, Hawk. Well, Hawk, they can get your location in a number of ways. For instance, if you've ever registered with a website to get customized information, like from weather.com or some other site, they normally want you to put in your zip code and your city. Well, that customization then allows you to get local news, weather, and also localized advertising. Now, that site also may pass on your location information to other sites or to advertising services, so then they can figure out where you are located. Now, the second way that they could get it is using your ISP location, Internet Service Provider location. This is the most likely culprit. What you do when you sign up for an Internet Service Provider, they assign an IP address to you out of their block of IP addresses, and that's your external address for talking to the internet. So that block of IP addresses is assigned to your ISP, and people can look up that IP address, and they can assign the location of your internet service provider as your location.
Mm-hmm.
So if your internet service provider is located in Bowie, Maryland, then they're going to say you're located in Bowie, Maryland. But if you're in an internet service provider, for instance, is in Baltimore, they're going to say you're in Baltimore. So that's the most likely culprit, that they're getting the data from your internet service provider. Now, the least likely culprit, but it is a possibility, you know, you can have GPS-enabled devices on your, you know, like you could be, you know, surfing the web with GPS-enabled devices, and you could sign up for services. You could log in to Google or to any kind of services, and sometimes they will grab the GPS information in your iPhone.
Wow.
Or your phone, and then they could use that information. So they could really geo-target you. And so it is possible that geo-targeted information could be shared with advertisers. This is the least likely option. I think it's mostly probably your ISP is doing it, and there's not much you can do about that. Mm-hmm. But great question. We got an email from John in Woodbridge. Dear Doc and Jim, Google recently introduced a tabbed interface to access automatically categorized email messages. It's randomly put mail into different categories, you know, like social, like advertising, like your main mailbox. Did you notice that, Jim?
I don't like it.
So how can I turn it off? Thanks, John in Woodbridge. Well, John, it's very easy to turn off the tabs. And actually,
what?
I turned them off.
Huh?
I turned them off. I got rid of them.
No kidding.
I hate them.
I hate them too.
Because it puts stuff in the wrong tab. It doesn't make any sense.
Things have a tendency to pile up on me, and I don't notice that they're there.
Yeah. So here's what you do. You go to Google, you log into Gmail, and in the upper right-hand corner, there's that little gear icon.
Mm-hmm.
The little gear icon.
I'm going to do this while you're telling
me. You click on that gear icon, and then you'll see there will be a drop-down menu, and you'll click on Configure Inbox.
Okay.
And then they have all these categories. You just deselect them. And when you deselect them, deselect all these other oddball categories, you're done. You're back to your old inbox.
There we go. It's beautiful.
It's done. It was done that quickly.
Stunning.
And the email, and then you didn't lose the emails in the other tabs. It just put them all back
the way it used to be.
There you go. Thanks, John.
Thank you, Doc.
There you go. And look how quick that was.
You made
my
life easier about 15 seconds.
Yeah. We got an email from Jeff. Dear Tech Doc, I just installed a new motherboard and CPU that's got 64-bit capacity, a 64-bit CPU. But I have a 32-bit operating system. Would it be worthwhile to upgrade the operating system to 64-bit? I have 64 gigabytes of RAM, and from what I'm reading, it's not being accessed by the 32-bit operating system. Is this something to be concerned about? Thanks, Jeff. Well, Jeff, a 32-bit operating system can only reference 4 gigabytes of RAM. So that means that 3/4 of your RAM is not even being accessed.
So
or
not
addressed.
A full RAM.
Yeah, you've only got 4 gigabytes of RAM, and then your 12 gigabytes is just sitting there. Actually, your operating system is just ignoring it because it can't address anything beyond 4 gigabytes. Now, if you want to make full use of all the RAM, you need a 64-bit version because 64 bits can actually address 16 gigabytes, or it can address a lot more than that of RAM. So the advantage of the 64-bit system is that you can address more RAM. Now, if you move from a 32-bit to a 64-bit operating system, there's actually no upgrade path. You're going to have to buy a new operating system.
Ouch.
At the full price.
Ouch.
So that's one disadvantage. And then you're going to have to take and back up all of your data because you're going to reformat your hard drive, and then you're going to reinstall all of your applications in the 62-bit operating system. So you're going to have to back it up, reinstall, and then put in all your applications. You're talking about a fair amount of time bother. Yeah. Now, the question is, and this is the crux of the matter, do you need to do it? Now, you only need to do it if you are dealing with extremely large files. Like if you're, say, doing image processing, or you're doing video processing or movie processing, where you'd like to just dump the entire file into RAM, or if you got some giant spreadsheet and you'd like to put the entire spreadsheet in RAM, and say the spreadsheet is more than 4 gigabytes, and maybe the spreadsheet's 10 gigabytes. So, or the movie's 10 gigabytes. And if you had it all in RAM, you could actually process it much quicker. You wouldn't have to swap files in and out of RAM to do processing. And so, in certain instances, it's going to make a big difference if you use all the RAM.
Mm-hmm.
But for most people that just do Microsoft Word and just regular kind of run-of-the-mill processes, surf the web, you're not even going to use anything anywhere close to 4 gigabytes of RAM, so it's just not worth it. So I can't really answer your question because I don't know what your applications are. Now, if you're like me and you've got 16 gigabytes of RAM, you're going to want to address it whether you use it or not. So I have a 64-bit system, and I have a 64-bit operating system. Because if I got the RAM, I want to address it,
sure,
whether or not I need it for the big file.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a matter of principle. So, and I doubt whether I really need to address more than 4 gigabytes of RAM, to tell you the truth.
But
I've got it, and I'm happy.
It's the principle of the thing.
It is the principle. But the good news is, when I bought my laptop, I bought the 64-bit laptop with the 64-bit operating system, so I didn't have this additional cost of the upgrade.
Mm-hmm.
That was a great question.
Excellent question.
So I don't know whether to say yes or no, but if it were me...
You don't know what he's using it for.
That's right. I don't know what he's using it for. We got an email from Benoit in New Jersey. Dear Tech Talk, what is check disk, and when should I use it to fix my hard drive? Love the show, Benoit.
Yikes.
Okay.
This sounds like a problem.
Check disk. Okay, yeah. Well, check disk, and it's abbreviated CHKDSK, and of course it's designed to check the disk. It's a powerful and useful tool in diagnosing and repairing certain types of disk problems. Now, here's what you do. Check disk has been around since the very beginning of Windows. It goes actually back to DOS days.
Huh.
And check disk is an important tool for disk maintenance and for a variety of disk-related issues. You can access it in Windows by clicking on My Computer and then right-clicking on the disk you want to check. And then a menu comes up. You pick out the Tool tab. And at the top of the Tool tab, there's a little box that says Error Checking. And you press that button and you activate check disk. Now, you can access it from the command line by simply typing check disk, CHKDSK, and it will check the disk. If you wanted to repair any things that it finds, which might be useful, you'd do check disk, CHKDSK/R. Now, normally, check disk just checks the information stored on the drive. You know, it's a lot of overhead information, where the files are located, how big they are. There's like a directory. It looks for corruption in the directory, and that's the normal check disk, where there's a directory corruption that it could fix. Now, there's another part of check disk, and that's a fairly quick check because it just goes through that overhead stuff. There's also another part of check disk that checks for bad sectors. It tries to read every sector and identifies bad sectors. If it locates a bad sector, it actually then will keep the operating system from storing any data on the bad sector. So the bad sector scan takes a lot longer because you're scanning every single location on the drive instead of only those areas that are related to overhead. But if you've got all kinds of errors coming up and you didn't tell me what your problems were, like, you know, you've got CRC errors, you've got bad read-or-write errors, then, you know, this scanning for bad sectors would certainly make sense. Now, what check disk will not do, will not recover data. You know, if you want to recover data, that requires other programs. It won't recover files that have been deleted. If you want to recover a deleted file, you have to use a program like Recuva, R-E-C-U-V-A. I've talked about that earlier.
Yes, we have.
Recuva, you might use that. But it's simply good for blocking off bad sectors and for correcting any errors in the directory. But that was a good question, Benoit. We got an email from Jim in Michigan. Dear Tech Talk, I'm on lawn sometimes late at night, and being an IT student, I read about hackers using the night to scan for active IP addresses and then hacking them for fun. Can you recommend any free software to prevent backdoor attacks that would work alongside my antivirus and my Windows firewall? Also, should I change from my Windows firewall to another firewall? Thanks, Jim in Michigan. Well, using the firewall and anti-malware tools is really your best option. In your case, your firewall, your anti-malware were free. The Windows firewall is really quite a good solution, and I recommend that when people are traveling so they don't have to carry an extra hardware firewall around with them. Now, I would further recommend that you get a NAT router. A NAT is for Network Address Translation Router. This is a way to hook multiple computers to an internet connection. You've got a NAT router. It could be either a Wi-Fi router or it could be just a, Ethernet router. The NAT router is nice because it has a built-in hardware firewall, which is quite good. And the NAT firewall protection is actually probably better than the Windows firewall protection. So I would then plug your Windows machine into the NAT firewall. Then you're running two firewalls in series, which is what I do. Some people say, well, if you've got the NAT firewall, disconnect the Windows firewall. I like to leave them both on because I don't want somebody else on my network trying to get into my machine.
It's like two layers of protection that way, right?
It's two layers of protection, yeah. So if somebody even gets into your wireless network, you still got your machine protected. But some people say cascading firewalls slows things down a bit. I don't really care. I like having two in parallel. So I'll tell you, we love your emails.
Absolutely do.
Email us to techtalk@stratford.edu, and we'll talk to them on the show, or else we might get to them, and I might email back to you directly. Also, make certain you check us out at our Facebook page. That would be facebook.com/techtalkonline. I'm monitoring that page during the show, and we might talk about any of your comments while we are on the air. And we love you to go to stratford.edu or Tech Talk Online and check out the show.
Absolutely. And the show would be called Tech Talk Radio, heard every Saturday at 9 on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, and 107.7 FM HD2. Stand by. More, including profiles in IT, coming up next.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
Application and software developers shape our world. Those who design and build these systems are the leaders we follow. The School of Computer Information Systems at Stratford University's Tyson's Corner or Woodbridge campus offers programs with a real-world, hands-on education. In fact, many of today's Stratford IT grads are working in their chosen field. Make it work for you. Stratford University. Get working. Check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu. A rewarding future as a holistic caregiver or nurse practitioner. Combining the art of caring with the human science makes nursing today's breakout field. Stratford University's School of Nursing at the Tyson's Corner or Woodbridge campus offers a patient-centered approach with valuable core clinical training. Stratford provides a real-world education in nursing. In fact, many of today's Stratford nursing grads are working in their chosen fields. Make it work for you. Get working. Check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We're in the virtual faculty lounge of Stratford University, and now it is time for
Profiles in IT.
Yes, today we're going to feature Evie Nemeth. Evie Nemeth was an engineer known for her expertise in computer system administration and networks. She is best known as the godmother of Unix administrators.
Aha. Uh-huh.
You didn't realize
that? I had no idea.
Yeah, Unix administrators do. There is a godmother for Unix administrators. Evie Nemeth was born June 7th, 1940. She grew up in Vermont. Got her bachelor's degree in mathematics at Penn State University in 1961, and she received her Ph.D. in mathematics at the University of Waterloo in Canada in 1971. Now, Evie Nemeth worked in Boulder during the summers starting around 76. This was, I guess she was working in her Ph.D. program, so she was working the summers there in Boulder, and she sort of became attached to Boulder, so when she got her, she got her degree in 71. So I guess she was working the summers in 76 while she was, you know, bumping around jobs after getting her Ph.D. Mm-hmm. She sort of liked Boulder. Then in 1980, she landed a full-time job with the Colorado University as associate professor. And she taught networks, data structures, Unix tools, and system administration. Now, she was really known at the university for developing undergraduate students. She loved to take young kids who were just starting out in computer science and really inspire them to become computer professionals. And so she made a huge difference to the undergraduate computer science program at Colorado University there in Boulder. Now, her math skills were really quite powerful. She found some deficiencies in the Diffie-Hellman problem. This is Diffie-Hellman encryption is used for cryptography, and she found some issues with it, which she published. And so that was actually quite a quite an interesting mathematical problem. She has an Erdos number of 2.
What does that mean?
The Erdos, this is a how close she is in terms of references to the mathematician Erdo. And I'm going to explain that. I'm going to have an aside.
You're going to have to explain this.
I'll explain that after the profile in IT because it's quite a long explanation. But knowing about the Erdo number, that's his E-R-D-O-S, is kind of interesting. So I thought I'll just feature that after the profile in IT. Now, in 1983, just 3 years after she started there at Boulder, she bought a house in Sunshine Canyon. Now, actually, what she did, she purchased an old water pump house from the county, and then she transported it up into the canyon. And she was quite a rugged person. She relied on a wood burning stove for heat, and she used composting toilets. Have you ever heard of composting toilets?
No, and I don't think I want to go into that.
Yeah, I think so. So, in other words, she had no septic tank. She just kept everything. She just kept everything right there.
Natural,
right,
she
just kept everything right there at the house.
Wow.
Yeah, she probably had quite the fertile garden
and not too many friends. Not too many dinner parties.
Yeah, not too many. Now, her house burnt down in 2013. Just this year, she lost everything there, but she had plans to rebuild it, and she just bought a historic cabin on Main Street in Gold Hill, Colorado. So she was definitely going to stay in the Colorado area. Now let's get back to her technical stuff. In 1989, she wrote the Unix System Administration Handbook. This became the Bible for Unix administrators, and this is where she basically got her name, Godmother of Unix Administrators. She revised that handbook in 1995 and in 2000. She also published the Linux Administration Handbook in 2002, and she revised that in 2006. In 2010, she authored the combined Unix and Linux System Administration Handbook. All are bestsellers and all explain the basics of network topology and administration simply without recourse to hype. She was a great communicator. She saw the need to simplify the language of the IT industry, a language that she felt many times did more harm than good. So her books were very readable, very understandable, and great teaching tools. In addition to teaching at several universities throughout her career, she spent 8 years working with the Cooperative Association for Internet Data Analysis at the University of California in San Diego. She spent time organizing the Internet Engineering Curriculum, a repository of IT training tools for the academic world. She was working with Vint Cerf, by the way, who was the one of the co-founders of the Internet and one of the co-developers of TCP/IP. She also worked with Apple co-founder Steve Wozniak to set up academic scholarships in the industry. Evie Nemeth retired from teaching in 2002 and bought a sailboat and began sailing the world.
Uh-huh.
She was a keen and experienced sailor who devoted much of her time on the water since retirement. She was very well respected in the cruising community as well as in the Unix administration community. But there's a sad story coming up. Nemeth was sailing just this last month off the coast of New Zealand in a 21-meter vintage wooden schooner. She had met its owner in New Zealand, and he was going to take a cruise. And she said, "Why don't you come along with us?" It was a wooden, and she said, "Okay." So that she went out, and they were cruising in June, and the boat disappeared.
Wow!
The boat disappeared. The last communication from the boat that she was sailing on occurred June 4th, 2013, and it was actually a message from Nemeth, where she requested some meteorological information about the rough weather they were encountering. She's presumed to have died either in June or July 2013. Mm. New Zealand authorities have formally called off the search, but her friend said at least she died doing what she loved.
Well, that's true.
So there you go. The godmother of Unix administrators, Evie Nemeth, who made a tremendous mark as a teacher and as a communicator and more recently as a sailor.
Interesting, and I hope you were paying attention to that, because we're going to reward your knowledge with the prize of free food. I mean, it's better than just getting an A, isn't it, Doc?
Yeah, it is much better than getting an A, because you get two tickets to fine dining at the Escoffier Dining Room or the Carême Dining Room.
So hope you're paying attention. We're going to play the pop quiz coming up next on Tech Talk Radio on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, and 107.7 FM HD2. Be right back.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
Technology is constantly changing. An effective IT manager must not only understand the possibilities and limitations of the technology, but also the requirements and constraints of the business world. Enhance your career today with a master's degree from Stratford University School of Computer Information Systems. Classes are offered day, evening, and weekends to match your busy schedule and are taught by experienced faculty members with industry experience. Earn your master's degree in as little as 15 months with an accelerated program in software engineering, information systems, information assurance, or telecommunications. Learn more about earning your master's degree from Stratford University at stratford.edu or call 1-800-444-0804. Disclose statements available at stratford.edu/disclosures. Stratford University, 1-800-444-0804.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
And now it's time for Washington's most popular and longest running radio game show, the Stratford University Pop Quiz. Now here's your host and star of our show. No, it's not Gene Rayburn. It's not Alex Trebek. It's not Richard Dawson. It's Dr. Richard Schertz.
Welcome back to the classroom of the airways. This is not a radio show.
No, it is not.
This is bait and switch. We have you tune into a radio show, and then we turn it into a classroom of the airways.
And
what kind of professor is that? Tricks his students into the classroom.
It's a tricky professor for sure.
Yeah, very tricky. Well, of course, if there's a classroom of the airways, there must be an assessment. This would be, as they call, a summative assessment.
That is the PC version for test.
That would be a test, yes. Mm-hmm. And if you get the correct answer to this pop quiz, you'll receive two tickets to fine dining, the Escoffier Dining Room and the Carême Dining Room. Earlier in the show, I was talking about Evie Nemeth, who, of course, is the godmother of Unix administrators, went right after she started working at at Colorado University in Boulder. She moved a house there that was situated in Sunshine Canyon. What kind of toilet did Evie Nemeth install in that house?
We have sunk to new depths here, so
that's
to speak.
Right. You thought this was a technology show.
This is technology?
It is technology.
It's low-grade technology, technology.
This is biotechnology.
Yes, it is.
This is the ultimate biotechnology.
It is indeed. If you have the answer to this question, you need to get it to us right now. If you're calling from west of Vermont, it's 877-936-9333. From east of Boulder, Colorado, 877-936-9333. And, of course, everybody else can call on the wild card line, which is 877-936-9333. But wait, there's another option.
If you're calling from New Zealand or Antarctica, you can call via Skype. Simply connect to Tech Talk Radio 1, and your phone call will be forwarded directly to the studio.
So there you have it.
So earlier in the show, I was talking about Evie's ERDO number.
Mm-hmm.
That's ERDOS, ERDO number. And she has an ERDO number of 2. Now, the ERDO's number is a collaborative distance between a person and a mathematician by the name of Paul Erdos. He, as measured by authorship of mathematical papers. Now, Paul Erdos was an influential mathematician who spent a large portion of his later life living out of a suitcase and writing papers with those of his colleagues who were willing to give him room and board. He published more papers during his life, 1,525 papers, than any other mathematician in history. The idea of the Erdos number was created by the mathematician's friends as a humorous tribute to his humorous output as one of the most prolific modern writers of mathematical papers. The Erdos number became well known in scientific circles as a tongue-in-cheek measurement of mathematical prominence. To be assigned an Erdos number, an author must co-write a research paper with an author with a finite Erdos number. For instance, Paul Erdos' Erdos number is zero because he's the guy.
Because he's
anybody right. Anybody else's Erdos number is K plus one, where K is the lowest number of any one of the co-authors. So, like, if you published a paper with Paul himself, you'd have an Erdos number of one. And then if somebody else would publish with you, mm-hmm. they would have an Erdos number of two because they would be twice removed from Paul himself.
It's like being a second cousin.
It's like a second cousin in mathematical authorship. So Evie's Erdos number was two, which is quite impressive. So there you go.
Interesting. Now, we do have somebody on the line. Let us go to line number one and turn that down too. This is Steve calling us from... You have a 202 exchange. Where are you calling from, Steve?
Yes, I'm calling on my cell phone. I'm in Hunt Valley, Maryland.
Hunt Valley. Excellent. Yeah. How are you listening to us today?
On my car radio.
Oh, gotcha. Oh, good.
Very good.
The Mighty 1500.
So earlier in the show, welcome back to biotechnology. Earlier in the show, we talked about Evie Nemeth, and of course, she built her own house in the canyon. What type of toilet did Evie install in that house?
Yes, she installed a composting toilet.
That is correct.
Steve, very good.
Two tickets, fine dining to the Escoffier dining room or the Carême dining room.
Thank you for listening and for paying attention today on the Pop Quiz on Tech Talk Radio. Stand by. Our assistant professor for prize distribution,
yes,
Andrew Mitchell, will be right with you and take your information. You are indeed listening to Tech Talk Radio on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, and 107.7 FM HD2. We'll be back right after this.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
A budget analyst, a vice president of sales. These are today's business leaders, and a degree from Stratford University's Tyson's Corner or Woodbridge campus offers you a powerful path to navigate the corporate world. The School of Business Administration at Stratford University offers both bachelor's and master's degree programs for a real-world education. In fact, many of today's Stratford business grads are working in their chosen fields. Make it work for you. Get working. Check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu. An executive chef at a trendy restaurant, a hotel general manager at a prestigious resort. These are the high-profile positions in the culinary arts and hospitality management industry. Get working towards your bachelor's or master's degree at Stratford University's Tyson's Corner or Woodbridge campus. In fact, many of today's Stratford culinary arts and hospitality grads are working in their chosen fields. Make it work for you. Get working. Check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Biotech Talk Radio.
Uh-oh.
We're in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. Jim, what in the world is this composting toilet? I've never heard of one before.
This is used, according to our friends at Wikipedia, is used in situations where there is very little water that can be used and there is no sewage treatment facility. So basically, this is a dry composting situation for basically... the excrement, and it is normally mixed with sawdust or coconut core or peat moss, and it looks like from the schematic I can see of this thing is that it's all self-contained indoors, so it doesn't wind up going outside. It stays in some sort of containment unit beneath, shall we say, the vessel, right?
Interesting.
And it basically breaks it down into dry nutrients.
Very good.
And there is a version of this system that when solar heat is used, it's called a solar toilet. Now, these things are actually used in national parks in the United States. So if you go to one of the national parks, and apparently where there isn't, you know, water service, you may be using this type of facility.
Okay, that's very nice. So I guess she was living off in a remote area,
she
and she
must
didn't,
have been,
she didn't
yeah.
want to affect the, you know, the neighboring ecology. Well, have you've heard of 3D printers?
Absolutely, yes.
Well, now and you've heard of non-duplicatable keys, where you cannot, where you know, you can't take a key to a locksmith and have him make it because it's technically illegal to duplicate it. Well, now three MIT students have figured out how to make non-duplicatable keys using a 3D printer workaround.
Oh no.
All you need is a flatbed scanner, an original Primus lock key made by Schlage, and some code that the students revealed at the DEF CON hacking conference. David Lawrence, Eric Van Albert, and Robert Johnson demonstrated the fact that reliance on older technologies like these high security keys might be in need of an update. They actually submitted their designs to 3D printing services, including Shapeways, iMaterialese, and they were mailed back fully working copies of different materials, keys made from different materials, including titanium. With sharing sites like Pirate Bay, now supporting 3D models, you can easily share a scenario where somebody could upload the formula for their neighbor's front key, and people could just make the key, you know, order it, and they could get it at will. So there may be need for a different type of security technology now with these 3D printers. Encrypted email is now becoming the norm in Germany. Two of the biggest internet service providers in Germany, Deutsche Telekom, which owns T-Mobile, and United Internet AG, are going to start automatically encrypting their customers' emails. Now, the encryption is going to be slow at first, possibly due to the speed of the rollout, but it will only be secure between T Online email service and United Internet's email systems. But this covers almost two-thirds of all the email addresses in Germany, and that's going to give an end-to-end encryption for email. The reason they're doing this? Because of NSA Internet surveillance.
Wow.
And they don't like the fact that the feds are snooping.
I think a lot of us don't like
that. That's right. And so even though NSA said it targets only foreigners for surveillance, actually, everybody in Germany is viewed as a foreigner. So they're figuring if their email, you know, passes through any of the cloud services in the U.S., it's going to be picked up. NSA released some information on the on their security programs a couple of weeks ago, where they basically kind of explained how they work. They're trying to kind of justify what was going on, and they said that actually they only touch about they said the internet provides about 1,800 petabytes of information a day, 1,800 petabytes of information a day. And NSA is only nabbing about 1.6% of that. So they said, you know, what's 1.6%? That's not that much, you know. Of course, it's a lot of petabytes of data. And what they do is that they were trying to say they only connect with people who are talking to foreign entities that look suspicious. But what they actually do, they grab all the data, they put it into big servers, and then they data mine it. So they actually grab a lot of data that they're not supposed to have, but they say it doesn't count because we only grabbed it. We're not looking at it. You see, so collecting is different than using. You understand? So they have this distinct. So they grab everything, but they only data mine some of it.
In government speak, I guess that makes sense.
That's right. Now, and they're saying, "What? So really, we don't really do any sort of spying." But then that was NSA's story a couple of weeks ago. Then the Washington Post just came out with a big description of all of the privacy rules that are being broken by NSA. They said they're breaking thousands of rules a year with the way that they're scanning, and that basically there was an audit. an internal audit of the NSA standards, and that internal audit was never released to Congress. It was kept kind of secret.
Mm-hmm.
And you remember Snowden, the guy that swiped all those documents and released them?
Yep.
He sent this internal audit report to the Washington Post.
Oh, brother.
So the Washington Post got a copy of it, and they said most of the infractions involved unauthorized surveillance of Americans or foreign intelligence targets in the United States, both of which are restricted by statute. They range from significant violations of law to typographical errors.
Mm-hmm.
The document provided to the Post by NSA contractor Edward Snowden included a level of detail and analysis that was not routinely shared with Congress or the special court, the FISA court, that actually oversees surveillance. In one of the documents, agency personnel were instructed to remove details and substitute more generic language when reporting to the Justice Department or the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. In one instance, NSA decided that it need not report the unintended surveillance of Americans. Well, because they didn't intend to do it, so why report it? It was a mistake. So, you know, we don't need to report that.
No.
A notable example in 2008 was the interception of a large number of calls placed from Washington, D.C., when a programming error configured the area code 202, which was Washington's area code, instead of 20 for the international dialing code of Egypt.
Oh.
So a lot of people in Washington got their calls scarfed up.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this was just caught by a quality assurance review, and there was no reason to really report it.
No.
Now, the NSA audit obtained by the Post was dated May 2012. It contained 2,776 incidents in the preceding 12 months of unauthorized collection, storage, access to, or distribution of protected communications. Most were unintended. Many involved failures of due diligence or violations of standard operating procedures. The most serious incident included a violation of a court order and the authorized use of data of about 3,000 Americans and green card holders. The May 2012 audit was intended for agencies' top leaders and counts only incidents that occurred in NSA's Fort Meade headquarters. Other facilities in the Washington area were not included, and a government official speaking on the conditions of anonymity said that if they included all the collection facilities, the numbers would be substantially higher.
Wow.
So there you go. That's why the German ISPs are encrypting their emails. So because they really don't think. I think this is a problem that they need to straighten out.
Sounds like it.
Yes.
We are going to take a short break here, Doc, and we'll come back with the rest of the show.
Okay.
This is Tech Talk Radio on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, and 107.7 FM HD2. More right after this.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
Application and software developers shape our world. Those who design and build these systems are the leaders we follow. The School of Computer Information Systems at Stratford University's Tyson's Corner or Woodbridge campus offers programs with a real-world, hands-on education. In fact, many of today's Stratford IT grads are working in their chosen field. Make it work for you. Stratford University. Get working. Check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu. A rewarding future as a holistic caregiver or nurse practitioner. Combining the art of caring with the human science makes nursing today's breakout field. Stratford University's School of Nursing at the Tyson's Corner or Woodbridge campus offers a patient-centered approach with valuable core clinical training. Stratford provides a real-world education in nursing. In fact, many of today's Stratford nursing grads are working in their chosen fields. Make it work for you. Get working. Check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. Google goes dark for 2 minutes last Friday.
How did I miss this?
Actually, August 16th. Was that last Friday?
That was yesterday.
Yesterday. Oh, yeah, that was Friday.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is Saturday. Yeah. You know, time is just flying.
It's just flying by.
That's right. The event began approximately at 4:37 p.m. Pacific time. So that would have been 7:30 p.m. That would be 7:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. So that would have been 7:30 last night in Washington. Google went dark for 2 minutes. All of the Google app services reported being back on by 4:48. So it actually, to get everything back on took about 11 minutes, but everything was off for a couple of minutes. The incident apparently blocked out every service that Mountain View has to offer simultaneously, from Google Search to Gmail, YouTube, Google Drive, and beyond. According to WebM Analytics firm Go Squared, the worldwide internet traffic dropped by 40%.
No kidding.
During the brief 2 minutes that Google services were offline. Isn't that amazing?
That is amazing.
40% of all internet traffic was running through the Google server. It's incredible.
It is.
Exactly how this operation happened, we don't really know. Nobody really can figure it out. And Google isn't talking.
Of course not.
Well, we'll see. You know, maybe by Monday they'll be talking about it.
They're probably still trying to figure out what happened, right?
That's right. They're still trying to figure out what's happening. Well, Apple patents will block some phone imports. You know, Apple, you know, they had the Steve Jobs patent. He was going to have a nuclear war with him and Google to try to shut down everybody. And he was going to shut down the Android phone, shut down Samsung with his patents. That hasn't worked out too well, but it's working out sort of well in certain instances. And the International Trade Commission has ruled that Samsung has violated some of Apple's iPhone patents and will block some of Samsung's phones that are being imported into the U.S. Specifically, the Internet Trade Commission said Samsung violated the Steve Jobs patent that covers a lot of swiping gestures that are used on touchscreen phones. The ITC also said that Samsung violated a patent that has to do with the iPhone's headphone jack.
Huh.
The news comes a few days after President Obama vetoed an order from ITC to block some older iPhone and iPad models from being imported to the United States because they infringed on Samsung's patents. So it was in the reverse situation. He just overrode it. People are waiting 60 days to see if he will veto this ban too. Apple did not comment, but Samsung is not happy. Okay, Bitcom ticker is now available. You know, they've got, like, Bloomberg has tickers, like stock price tickers.
Mm-hmm.
Now Bloomberg terminal users can get the official Bitcom streaming ticker, watching the Bitcoin, getting the value of Bitcoins, reported in real time by Bloomberg. So this is making Bitcoin look more legitimate. The data comes from the ubiquitous Bitcoin exchange called Mt. Gox, as well as from Tradehill. Only Bloomberg employees can access the ticker, but this feature should make way to the regular Bloomberg terminals under the label XBT. The ticker probably shows that Bitcoin is worth about a dollar over time. Traders will have to use Bitcoin exchange service like Mt. Gox or Tradehill for transactions. They won't be able to execute buy or sell orders from their Bloomberg terminals. That could be the last technical difficulty before investing some time and money in Bitcoins. Now, what Bitcoins are, I have to say, this is a kind of an encryption method where they've created value on the internet because certain encrypted sequences are very difficult to discover. And so the Bitcoin formula is that you have to discover these particular sequences, and you might have to invest a huge amount of computer time to discover them. And once you've discovered them, that particular discovered sequence can function as a Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm.
So they have Bitcoin miners, or these high processor machines that are trying to discover these sequences. And as more and more Bitcoin sequences are discovered, the next ones are even harder to discover. The first ones are easier. They get harder and harder and harder as they go along. And so this is actually a way to trade money, and all of the transactions are public. All of the sequences are public. So when you trade a particular Bitcoin, everybody knows you've traded it, so you can't trade it twice. And it actually has all the features of money. So this is one of the first systems that doesn't really depend on government. Now, actually, there are always two types of money that have always been, you know, that we've always been, that we're familiar with. One type of money gets its value from linking to something of value, like linked to gold or linked to silver or linked to gemstones. It's like the gold standard. We used to have a gold standard dollar. The other kind of money is what they call fiat. It's money by fiat. It just derives its value from the fact that the government or central authority guarantees it.
Mm-hmm.
So now the U.S. got off the gold standard, and so they issue this paper and they just guarantee it. But it's not tied to anything, and so its value is simply declared. So it's called a fiat standard because it's just declared by as a fiat, and there's no backing to it. So Bitcoin is the world's first world's most successful digital currency, and it defies any time of classification system. It's neither a fiat type of system nor is it a representative system. It's not a fiat because its supply is actually finite, because there are only so many combinations that can be discovered, and then once you reach that number of combinations, no more bitcoins can be created. So it's not by fiat because it's got a finite supply, and more importantly, it's not backed by any central banking authority.
Mm-hmm.
It's not representative because it's not linked to anything physical. So it's like this new kind of money that people are trying to figure out. Now, it's actually pretty clever because you can trade using being totally anonymous. So the government's afraid that people are going to, you know, do drug traffic on
sure.
illicit things. There is no monetary control because, you know, most governments, you know, control the flow of money, the printing of money. That's how they can manage their economy. There is no monetary control here. So the governments are saying, hey, wait a minute here. What about the central bank? You know, we've got no part of that. There's also no transaction fee. And so it becomes very difficult to control. So many people are beginning to believe that if Bitcoin continues to grow in popularity, that somehow the government's going to step in and shut it down, because really the U.S. government likes to print their own money. They don't want another standard out there. And so this will be interesting to watch. Now, you might wonder who's making money with Bitcoin. You've got the Bitcoin exchange run by the Winklevoss twins.
Uh-huh.
These are the guys that sued Facebook. You've got BitPay, which processes Bitcoin payments. You've got Butterfly Labs that makes hardware for mining them. You've got Coinbase, which is a provider of digital wallets that holds a digital money. You've got Silk Road, which is another exchange where you can buy Bitcoin. So people are making money on Bitcoins, but it is a bit controversial.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, the show is over. We love you listening to us. Check us out on Tech Talk Online, and go to stratford.edu and check out the programs and say you heard about them on Tech Talk.
And speaking of programs, if you missed part of this or would like to hear it again, we replay today at 3 o'clock here on Federal News Radio. See you next week.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program. WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWT-FM HD2 Manassas. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. The Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, American University Eagles, Washington Nationals, and the Washington Capitals. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.
And, of course, the Nats are on the air later today against the NL East leading Atlanta Braves. Game coverage starts at 6:30, first pitch at 7:05 here on Federal News Radio. It is going to be partly sunny today, highs near 80 degrees. Tonight, some rain and then some showers tomorrow, so a wet weekend. Right now, it is 67 outside our studios in Northwest at 10 a.m.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take